everybody. You can see my presentation?
Yes.
Perfect. Okay.
I would like to welcome you also on behalf of my colleague, Knut-Helene Meyer, who's involved in a workshop just now and unfortunately cannot be here. I'm pleased to be able to present our joint reflections on the development of the sense of coherence during the life of Victor von Weizsäcker. The name of Weizsäcker, von Weizsäcker, will be familiar to many of you. Richard von Weizsäcker was the German president at the time of the fall of the Berlin Wall and the reunification of Germany in 1989, and his older brother, Carl Friedrich, was nominated for the Nobel Prize several times as a physicist and a peace researcher. Both are nephews of the physician and philosopher Victor von Weizsäcker, who founded the Heidelberg School of Anthropological Medicine in the first half of the 20th century. Based upon epistemological considerations and empirical findings on the relationship between perception and movement, he formulates, to research human beings, one has to participate in life, a maxim that remains valid unchanged. The aim of our psychobiographical presentation is to reflect the life and work of this extraordinary individual in the light of the development of the sense of coherence. Further on, we want to show how central aspects of his work can be integrated into the model of cytogenesis. Finally, we want to discuss the consequences of his work in the health sector. Our considerations are based on von Weizsäcker's work, in particular his autobiographical writings, information from contemporary witnesses, and biographical analysis by third persons. We have analyzed this information in particular with regard to the experience of consistency, adequacy of demands, and opportunity for participation and emotional closeness. That is to say, those conditions that are considered to be conducive to the formation of a strong sense of coherence. For our presentation, we have summarized the available data into life phases and taken into account central historical framework conditions. Victor von Weizsäcker was born in 1886 and thus in a time of the prospering German Empire. During this time, his father achieved growing social influence, was ennobled, and for many years was prime minister of Württemberg, a significant part of southern Germany. Victor grew up together with three siblings in comfortable circumstances, easily graduated from high school, studied medicine and philosophy, and received his doctorate in 1910 with a physiological thesis on blood velocity. He was endowed with high cultural and social capital and also created his own social network and philosophical debating clubs. His SOC can be considered high. During World War I, Victor worked as a military doctor, experienced the suffering of friends and comrades, and became aware of how social differences became less important in the face of danger. He experienced the individuality of illnesses and the great influence of human support. He was appreciated, but remained a loner. Against all odds, he rehabilitated himself in 1917 with a work on metabolism of the heart. While his father abdicated and his family lost influence, Victor welcomed the collapse of the empire. He saw the war as a great global and cultural crisis that demanded a fundamental reorientation in which he wanted to participate. Oh. Beg your pardon. Parallel to the social awakening in the Weimar Republic, Victor personally gained independence and profile. In 1920, he received a professorship in neurology in Heidelberg and married in the same year. His four children were born in the following years. He sought on value-based approach to science and clinical practice, transcending denominational boundaries. During this extreme productive phase of his life, he wrote his works on the psychodynamics of physical illness and his drafts for a holistic and social medicine. He made contact with Freud, Boob, and others, but remained a scientific outsider. During the Nazi regime and World War, During the Nazi regime and World War II, Weizsäcker withdrew more and more from the public eye. However, he continued to maintain private contacts with, for example, the physicist Heisenberg and the philosopher Heidegger. At the time, he completed his fundamental studies on the relationship between perception and movement, called Gestaltkreis. During the war, he lost his two sons, fled from Wroclaw, where he had a proper chair, and was taken prisoner at the end of the war. This phase is marked by experiences of great powerlessness. After the war, in his old age, Victor experienced public recognition and rehabilitation as a person and was able to get his program off the ground, but the preceding personal losses, not only the both sons, but also his daughter who committed suicide, and he himself got seriously ill and had to retire early. These personal losses were enormous and the fundamental doubts massive. The remaining strength probably comes primarily from a despite all this and the reference to the future that may also lie after him. Nevertheless, fundamental works such as his autobiographical writings and his late work, Pathos of Fee, were produced during this time. Our analysis points to a parallelism of basic social sentiment, family shaping power, and personal development. The phases of life were essentially co-structured by the historical development. This is reflected to some extent in the development of his scientific work. Childhood, adolescence, and post-adolescence appear as phases of carefree development. Middle adulthood and old age as redesigns responding to incompassing crises associated with wars and Nazi dictatorship. The last phase of his life was characterized by the simultaneity of mourning and declining strength on the one hand, and unbreakable conviction regarding the soundness of his approach on the other. His work would have to be carried on by others. One of them was his close nephew, Carl Friedrich von Weizsäcker. A closer analysis of the family history of the Weizsäckers reveals that over six generations, it has produced outstanding theologians, jurists, politicians, philosophers, doctors, scientists, and artists up to now, who have exerted influence in high social positions. This is a vivid example of the effectiveness of a cross-personal sense of family coherence. We have tried to relate central aspects of anthropological medicine to the dimensions of SOC. In Weizsäcker's concept, the aspect of manageability corresponds to it formation, that is to say, the symptom formation as a creative act in the regulation of ego-environment relationships. A quote, illness is not only suffered, but also made. The aspect of comprehensibility is found in Weizsäcker's plea for biographical understanding of illness. Nothing organic has no meaning. Therefore, you have to ask, why just here? Why just now? Why just like this? The dimension of meaningfulness finds its correspondence in Weizsäcker's concept of bipersonality, according to which patient and physician encounter each other as persons with their own expertness, which must be recognized. A quote, introducing the chapter to medicine. Furthermore, Weizsäcker draws attention to the social character of health and illness. Illness is not only in, but also between persons. Three aspects of anthropological medicine in particular are worth integrating into the salutogenesis concept: the role of the body, the introduction of the subject, and the fundamental orientation towards the future. The lived body is a socialized body, a part of the social body in which social as well as individual experiences are inscribed, and which in turn gives expression to its meaning-making and the regulation of ego-environment relations. It is an acting as well as a suffering body, which wants to be understood with nature scientifics as well as with hermeneutic methods. Understanding is not possible without active self-involvement and demands the introduction of the subject. This applies to science and practice, but also to politics and everyday life. Finally, it is necessary to understand our action from the point of view of aimed goals that are often not conscious. This begs the question, what will this once have been good for? Even the symptom. We think that many of Weizsäcker's thoughts are still relevant today. Thus, in times of a war against the virus, one could ask with Weizsäcker, how much longer are physicists and generals to determine our view of the world instead of poets and artists? Thank you so much.
Wow, that is definitely an impressive presentation, Ottmar. Beautiful findings. I still have to bit, you know, how do you call that? Reflect on that inside, because it's quite a lot and a beautiful last saying. And I think that resonates very well with a lot of feelings that people have working in salutogenesis. So Shanta, did you already get some people who are asking questions? You have to unmute Shanta.
There are no questions at this time.
No, I can understand that people always need to, you know, have some time to reflect. While we wait for that, I have a question for you, Ottmar. And that is, can you reflect a bit more on how a salutogenic oriented psychobiographical actually differs from a regular one? And how could this be specifically useful for medical practice?
Yes, I think we don't need the folio any longer.
No, you can stop sharing if you want to. Definitely, yeah. Then we see a bit more of the people. Yeah. Yes, we're back. Hello, everyone.
Okay. Yes. The main point is that you have to understand people in the way they understand themselves. That is to say, you have to open the room for narratives. People are the experts of their own illness, but they don't know it often. Sometimes they know, but often they don't know it, and they become aware of it by talking. So it needs questions, of course, but Weizsäcker calls it a transjektives Verstehen. You have to see the person with the eyes of the person himself, if he could understand himself. That is to say, you have to feel the suffering and to help the person to make use of it. And one of the main question is, what is this problem, whatever it is, may once it have been good for? What is, it's not only deficiency, but it's a part of the problem solving. I think Theon will know it.
Yeah, I think also. Maybe Theodore, you also have an additional question perhaps to Ottmar. You have to unmute Theodore, please.
Thank you. Yes. No, I have no question. Thank you.
No, okay. I would like then to thank you, Ottmar. I think you have very new insights. I had not heard of the concept of family coherence. So that is, that may be me, but maybe Shanta, did you know about family coherence?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
It is,
I need to dive into that, definitely. My topic is about food and eating. And that's a lot about family.
Absolutely.
So thank you again, Ottmar, for this really wonderful presentation. And then I'm off to introduce our second speaker, Paul. Paul Battle, I think. Butler?
Batilla.
Oh, that's a difficult one. That's a beautiful one.
Battle is the traditional speaking in English. So that
Yeah, I would say battle, but that's of course.
Yeah, it's quite normal. So
not Spanish. No. You're from Dipsalud, Public Health Organization of Girona. You're in your home, the conference city, which is a wonderful city. I have visited it once for another conference, and I've been eating very well. So, Paul, you're going to present on Teal and Freedom Frameworks, a strategy to implement Salutogenesis in health team management.
Okay, so let's go.
Are you ready to share the screen?
Yes, I am ready.
Perfect, thank you.
Are you seeing it?
Yes, perfect.
Yes,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Well, good afternoon, everybody. My name is Paul Batlle. And I am make the presentation in behalf of the whole of the team. Thank you very much to the organization to allow us to present our experience in the Observatory on Social Determinants, Health, Inequalities, and Well-being, related to how we introduce the salutogenic approach in the team managing. We are going to explain the use of TIL and Freedom Frameworks as a strategy to implement this salutogenesis, the salutogenesis approach in the intermediate time slot. Okay. Well, the work environment has a great impact on people's health. The work climate and psychosocial risk are key issues in the framework of health promotion, and also in the occupational health. This topic is of interest both managers and researchers. The traditional and dominant perspective of the human team management approach continues to focus on controlling, supervising, and motivating strategies to improve employee job performance. In most of these models, the framework that underpins them is a negative focus of the person. And so what dominates is distress. The salutogenic perspective provides a positive framework that offers opportunities to change approach. A new work environment management model could align with people's sense of coherence and generate health and well-being for people and workers. New trends have emerged in the management sector, for example, TIL or Freedom models, that suggest a possible alignment of these conceptual frameworks with salutogenic approach. Our roles, firstly, focus on team management from a perspective of the capabilities, the potentialities, strengths, and assets of people and teams. Second one, build a work environment with in line with SOC, so comprehensibility, manageability, and mindfulness, and the four basic general resistance resources, staying in contact with own feelings, existential thoughts, social support, and mindfulness activities, according to Lamstrom and and Monica Erickson. And finally, implement a team management strategy based on TIL and freedom models. As a methods, firstly, we did an analysis of the consistency between TIL and freedom models and Celotogenic framework. We are implementing the principles of TIL, so is wellness, cell management, and evolution we propose, and freedom, that is power, organizational purpose, and human development. And finally, we are doing a continuous evaluation of the implementation and at the personal satisfaction. Let's go to the results. We follow a qualitative approach. So the results cannot be generalized and only respond to the reality of our team. However, they can be used as an inspiring base for other teams who want to work towards a Celotogenic approach. In this slide, you could see the theoretical relations of the three models, TIL framework, freedom framework, and sense of coherence. Each models have three key elements. The firstly, the TIL model is based on, first of all, in wellness, which include the personal development, the truth in free will, and the capacity to be authentic with yourself. That is the possibility to be the same person inside or outside to the workplace. Secondly, in evolutionary purpose, that is the possibility to feel the dynamic vision of the organization. And the self-management, that is self-leadership, distributed power, and so on. As a freedom model, is based on the human development, which includes different concepts as self-knowledge, ego control, self-realization, personal satisfaction, and so on. The organizational purpose, that is the personal and collective compromise with the purpose of the organizational purpose. So which include the self-responsibility, the commitment with the mission, and how to play with the vital sense. And finally, the distribution of the power theory, which include the self-management, democracy and equity, shared intelligence, distributed leadership, and so on. And finally, we see the three dimensions of sense of coherence, comprehensibility, meaningfulness, and manageability. Studying the three models, we can adjust the triangles, putting in order the dimensions of each paradigm. So we can choose where we put the dimensions of each paradigm. And when we did so, we realized that aligning them, we could identify a logical similarities within them, as you can see in the slide. Observe how also the four basic general resistance recursos are there, taking a dynamic relation with TIL and freedom models. As a result, in the following slide, you can see a tool to evaluate a baseline of an organization or team related to organizational essential aspects, as for example, leader style, decision-making, salaries, work climate, truth, fair, and so on. Unfortunately, this tool arrived to us just a few months ago. For this reason, we couldn't do it at the first moment when we started the project. So the red line is the perceptions of the team where we were when we start working as a team in July 2019. As the red line shows, the perception of the team was that we were located within orange and green organizations, a little far from TIL proposals. The TIL line is the perception of the TIL about where we are now, 1.5 years later. As you can see, we are improving in all the items. Only the possibility to manage our salary doesn't improve because we work in an institution where the salary is according to a pre-established tariff. So step by step, we are working to TIL proposals. So the tool is useful for a continuous monitoring for our field progress. This tool is available in the link below in different languages. In the next slide, we show you the scores of team individual sense of coherence questionnaire. And in the red color, the medium score of team sense of coherence. Obviously, we are not looking for a statistical correlation within the two diagrams. We did this to put in contact as a theoretical level with a qualitative approach, this graphic with the level of implementation of Thiel Freedom Model. We are trying to understand in which way the different theories could be associated. So we don't give you any interpretation. It's just an opportunity to look and make questions. To conclude, from our point of view, a wide and solid theoretical conceptual coincidence has been found within Thiel, Freedom, and Solotogenic models. It's possible to implement a Thiel Freedom proposal based on horizontal participatory methods as a salutogenic approach. Team management from a perspective of capabilities, potentialities, strengths, and assets of people allows to a high level of motivation and involvement without the need to establish specific strategies for that, and a high level of satisfaction and well-being, both as a personal and professional level. Many thanks for your attention.
Thank you, Pau. Now, but I do need to read this one. You never change things by fighting the existing reality. To change something, build a new model that makes the existing model obsolete.
That's true. Yeah. That's what we are trying to do.
Yes, definitely. No, yes, that's definitely what you're trying to do. What a an exercise, a complicated exercise, right? To try to match all the elements and aspects of the of different models and create a new integrated one that can be applied actually in practice with, you know. So Shanta, did you get a...
Well, I have a question from one of the listeners. It's actually a request for the link that was provided in one of the subsequent slides.
Yes.
If that, I think that was, is that the Reinvorgat? Okay, perfect. Thank you for sharing that.
That was already a fast action from Oriol. I see. Thank you.
Are there any questions from our audience for Pau?
While we're waiting for the audience to put in some questions, Pau, I have a question for you, because you say that different models or the different ways of thinking so much align, right? That you found so different ways to connect. Can you reflect a bit on how do you think that comes? Are there some like shared origins somewhere, or what do you think about that?
Well, I think firstly you need to understand very well the three models to try to catch the similarities within them. So the first thing that you need to do is read a lot about the three theories, and when are you reading them, catch the parts of the models and trying to put together the common points. For example, the Thiel theory, they give you the triangle, for example, but not the freedom model. Freedom model is a general model that the triangle doesn't exist. So in that way, we need to build ourselves our own triangle of our interpretation of the freedom model, for example. So we try to put together the principles concepts in agrupations that take some sense with the sense of coherence of a salutogenic approach.
Yes, but I do think indeed that the developers of the other models must have also some kind of a salutogenic orientation. Somehow, maybe they picked it up somewhere in the line of their work. So that's wonderful, because in this morning's session, we discussed about could salutogenesis be used as the meta theory for, let's say, designing activities. But there's also, of course, the way like you did it, like try to more integrate them, integrate salutogenesis within the other theories rather than setting it like as an above framework. Well, for you, it was...
We are convinced that, in fact, TIL models and freedom models are giving us an easy solution to implement salutogenic strategy or approach in the teams managing. So sometimes we try to implement things through the salutogenic approach, and we don't have any tools available to do this. Yeah. So when you can or when some theories are right at your hands and you could see the similarities, maybe the more easy way to advance is just try to apply these new theories when the level of coincidence of theory at theory level are very high, as I show.
Yes, fascinating. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. I think we're ready for the next speaker, right, Shanta?
Yes, please. Thank you.
So thank you, Paul. And we're moving over to Theodore. Theodore Dirk Petzold is from Zentrum für Salutogenese. This is in German, right? I will try. Medizinische Hochschule Hannover, Germany, right? I bet you can pronounce that way better than I can, Theodore. And your presentation is about how can we apply salutogenic communication in different socio-cultural fields. And I'm very much looking to hear what about that, since my background is also in communication science. So the floor is yours, Theodore. Can you share your presentation?
Yeah, thank you very much, Laura, for the introduction. Yes, I'm a GP and psychotherapist. And during my lifelong learning, I explore the questions, how do mind and body work together? From this followed the questions, how can we make chaos developmentally healthy through mindful communication? To answer these questions, particularly and practically, as well as theoretically, I have developed the salutogenic communication based on a meta model of communicative psychophysical self and coherence regulation and salutogenic psychodynamics.
Theodore, we don't see your screen. Are you trying to share your PowerPoint?
I just want the next step. I want to share the screen, yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
I try to give you a brief overview of a broad field in 10 minutes. How can we apply salutogenic communication in different socio-cultural fields? Salutogenic communication is a communication method to guide people toward their own motivation, their meaningful aims, to strengthen their ability to act, and to increase their understanding and learning. It is based on a salutogenically oriented systemic psychology. Today, it is applied in various fields of practice, for example, in doctor-patient communication and psychotherapy, in nursing and the care of people with mental disorders, in co-creative teams, in employee dialogues, in local communication for regional development, and of course, in private interpersonal relationships. From this multitude of different fields of application, it can already be assumed that salutogenic communication is primarily a conscious attitude and less a technique. The focus of salutogenic communication is the stimulation of healthy self and coherence regulation. This self-regulation, like our lives, revolves around motivating attractive goals. It is ultimately about coherence. For all the different attractive goals, we have coined as a generic term attractiva, in reference to attractors in the chaos research, You find more about this model in my workshop yesterday. This first phase of the first phase of coherence regulation is about perceiving one's attractiva and the deviations from these. If a deviation is meaningful, we are motivated to act. After each activity, your organism reflects whether the interaction with the environment has brought us closer to our attractiva. From this reflection, we learn to understand our interactions and how to adapt our behavior to them in the future. As can be felt by looking at the photo of the child and its mother, the smile dialogue shows that they are happy, coherently connected through eye contact. This smile dialogue is an early communicative coherence experience. As psychologists have counted, infants can experience about 15,000 such smile dialogues in their first 4 months. If instead of this coherence experience, infants experience stress, such as rejection or are left alone a lot, this increases the risk of suffering from a chronic disease, even in adulthood. In pathogenetically oriented medicine, doctors and other therapists ask about chronic ailments, first, for the disease diagnosis, second, to find its cause, and third, to find ways to combat it. This neither leads to an understanding nor a cure, and to the patient's lack of coherence experience. It rather deepens it. Therefore, in the 1960s, the famous psycho-oncologist Lawrence Lucerne changed his approach. He switched from having the three pathogenically oriented questions he had in mind to only two, now salutogenically oriented questions before the term salutogenesis was created. First, what is okay, healthy, coherent in the patient? And second, what can he do and what can we do to make him feel better? He reports experiencing remissions of 50% after making the switch from the three pathogenetic questions to the two salutogenic ones. The Heidelberg-based researcher Ronald Kossat-Matisek achieved similar results doing autonomy training, which was become a foundation for salutogenic communication. In the meantime, we can explain the positive effects of these communicative approaches, which are salutogenically oriented at their core, on the basis of recent findings in neuroscience. We have three motivational systems: the approach, avoidance, and coherence system. These lead to different modes of behavior and metabolism, as well as even gene activities. The avoidance mode kicks in when we perceive a threat and is linked to the stress system. If it is turned on for a longer time, the risk for suffering from chronic diseases is increased. The approach system is turned on when we perceive something as tempting or if it need presents itself. It is linked to the pleasure neurotransmitter dopamine, the so-called internal reward system. It is experienced as positive motivation, but can also lead to addictive behavior. In the superordinate coherence mode, we can do without the dopamine kick. We can be composed even in the face of threat, considering carefully before an effect action occurs. If we ask for positive motivational goals, which are to lead people out of their stressful experience, we do not ignore people's fears and suffering. On the contrary, we accompany people to the deepest point of their fear and pain. And then at this deepest point of their suffering, we ask, what do you need to feel secure, safe, and confident again? This is how we find the turnaround out of the stressful avoidance mode towards the positive attractiva. In the overarching mode of coherence, we strive for coherence and for integration even of our approach impulses and avoidance impulses. We can take responsibility for our effect impulses, and our consciousness is reflective as an inner observer. This mode is felt a mode of serenity, a state of peace of mind. We can develop the state of consciousness through mindfulness, exercises, and meditation and reflecting. In the coherence mode, we also find the suprapersonal global orientation of confidence, so Antonovsky's definition of SOC. In order to get into the coherence mode again and again, a reflective handling of emotions is also helpful. Emotions arise in the pre-linguistic communication of needs. They reinforce the expression of a child's needs. For example, a child's angry crying shows that it wants to be heard and seen. A weeping shows the caregiver that the infant wants to feel connected. A person becomes angry when another person does not cooperate with him in a way that meets his expectations. In salutogenic communication, when emotions occur, we ask about the motivating need behind them. The person can then verbally communicate this as a need, wish, request, or something similar. Motivation is not only decisive for individual behavior, but also for our cooperation. Michael Tomasello found that the basis of successful cooperation is shared intentionality. When this is present, we can come together in an intentional resonance space and find coherence solutions dialogically and co-creatively. Therefore, we have developed a goal setting also for medical practices. In this process, the patient names health goals that are currently important and attractive to him. These should be formulated positively, an approach should be feasible, and success should be perceptible. In salutogenic communication, we accompany our clients cooperatively in their self-regulation towards coherence. At the beginning, we listen in order to tune in to our counterpart. With one ear, we hear wishes, needs, or spirit behind every complaint. With the other ear, we hear abilities and other resources. In the next step of the consultation, we become more active and ask more specifically, what is meaningful to you, or similar questions. We explore their motivation, their desired solution to a problem, their vision of a good life. Then we consider together what the client wants to do and what they can do in order to get closer to their attractiva. What can they do to themselves? Does the person have other resources besides its own abilities? If someone has already tried many options without the desired success, a change in perspective may be required. Then we ask him the third crucial question, what do you want to learn from the experience? In the final step of the consultation, we reflect on the solution we have found. Does it lead to convergence on the desired aim, ultimately to more coherence? Is it feasible? I want to end this brief outline on salutogenic communication with a takeaway from this conference. Coherence is infectious. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you so much, Theodore. Infectious is, of course, a well-known word these days, well chosen. People are still, I think, processing your wonderful presentation. I'm really intrigued. And am I right that I also hear a bit inspiration from, let's say, the motivational interviewing from Rolnick? I can also hear a bit of nonviolent communication techniques in this. And you seem to have captured this like beautifully. in a salutogenic framework, which to me again proves like salutogenesis can serve well as like a more overarching framework. Am I right, Theodore?
Think. Yeah, I want to. I can give you the slides, the presentation, in the chat. Is it okay?
Sure. Sure. Please, people ask that. Yes.
So yes, you can download it.
Laura, I have a question.
Yes, please.
Go ahead, please.
Theodore, in the slide where you were mentioned the three neuromotival systems in the approach, coherent goals, and avoidance, how does this relate to the neuro? Because you mentioned in the approach goal the dopamine.
Yes.
But what are the others in the coherent goals and the in the avoidance? Goals, one of these. I don't know if the question is clear.
Yes. The avoidance system is located in one center, but it's connected to many others in the amygdala.
Yes.
In the amygdala, and from there it is connected with the sympathicus, sympathetic nerve system. And the approach system is with the dopaminergic and dopaminergic system, nucleus accumbens, and some other centers. And the coherence system, I think, but that is a very new aspect, is in the prefrontal.
Prefrontal cortex.
Yes. And is I think it is with the ventral part of the vagus, nerve vagus connected, which the work Porges did work on it and some others. And it's connected with serotonin.
Perfect.
Yes, and so I think in this coherence system, we can we can find the center for the sense of coherence, for building up the center of coherence, the neuro motivational center.
Great, thank you so much.
You're welcome. May I say something to the other questions before? The family coherence and the team coherence. I think it's a systemic aspect that each system has a special coherence. And so you find a coherence of a family of each system, the system theory aspect, each system is having his own coherence. It's not always aware, but there is a coherence aspect. Yes.
Yes, that I think came also to the discussion yesterday. Can you say a bit more about whether you also think that then in these, that the, let's say that the shock, this, or the sense of coherence from people then can also, is also very situationally, very contextually, and can then kind of shift?
Oh, I think the sense of coherence is in the SOC, the measured the questionnaire looks for that, or evaluates or measures that what the people an individual has or learned to cope with his experiences with the world in his life. The childhood and so on, and the sense of coherence, this measurable SOC, the measure for this experience or the learning which one had, and maybe combined with the genetically disposition, preposition, Yes. And the other, all those motivational systems have a part which is predisposed genetically, maybe about 30%, and the rest, most of the manifestation is formatted by experiences. So both came together, genetical and experiences. And the SOC, I think, measured at one point of life your state of dealing coherent with the world, with life, and yes, and so it can change, not a little, and sometimes abruptly, but not very often in severe traumata and so on. But I think that is fits with the evaluation with the empirics.
Yes, definitely. Well, there is during this conference, of course, a big discussion on whether SOC is what it is actually measuring and how well it can be changed or adapted. So that is, I think, it may come back in the plenary as well after this session. I don't think there are any more questions. I see Pascal, you are having your video on. Were you having maybe a question or not? No, you don't have a question. Okay, that's fine. Thank you again, Theodore. And
thank you.
You're very welcome. I would like then to introduce our final speaker, which is Shanta Dubé. She is from Wingate University, Levine College of Health Sciences in California. And your topic will be pathogenesis to salutogenesis and understanding healing, resilience, and subjective well-being among adult survivors of childhood trauma. So your screen is looking perfect.
Great, so please, thank you. And just to clarify, I'm in California visiting family, but Wingate University is actually in North Carolina on the East Coast. So I'm toggling lots of different time zones, if you will. But I do so appreciate Theodore's presentation. I feel like it might be somewhat related to my work. And I just want to preface, I'm very excited to be presenting to this group. I've been reading Antonovsky's work for years and feel that it has much relevance to the work on the adverse childhood experiences and understanding childhood trauma and applying salutogenesis to this work. So I'm excited, and I also want to preface, I'm more of an epidemiologist, if you will. I'm not an anthropologist, though I love the field of anthropology, but I hope that all of you will gain some insights from the talk today and that we can have some more in-depth conversations. So the title is Pathogenesis to Salutogenesis, Healing, Resiliency, and Subjective Well-being Among Adult Survivors of Childhood Trauma. So the aims of my study, I'm going to provide an overview of the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study. I would love to know how many of you have heard of the ACEs study. If you could even just put a emojicon on your screen just to say, yes, I've heard of it. And then pathogenesis versus salutogenesis. Theodore did a nice overview, but I will give my perspective on this as well. And then applying salutogenesis to studying well-being among adult ACEs survivors. And Sandra Bloom has this wonderful quote, adverse childhood experience studies are as revolutionary as germ theory was for 19th century. So what we're going to really talk about today is all the work that has been done to understand the pathophysiology and ACEs through a pathogenic lens. But then I want to shift gears and think about how we look at survivorship and salutogenesis and healing and recovery. So this probably is not a surprise to any of you, This is just a slide showing what we deal with in the US in terms of the actual causes of death and the leading causes of death. But what we really need to understand, or what we were really trying to understand with the ACE study, are what are the underlying factors that contribute to the actual leading causes of death. The ACE study was launched between 95 and 97. It was a collaboration between the US Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and Kaiser Permanente. There were over 17,000 adult Kaiser Permanente health maintenance organization members who took part in the study. And the study examined the health, behavioral, and social consequences of multiple forms of childhood trauma. The types of ACEs we examined, these are the individual categories. There were 10 separate ACEs. Essentially, these 17,000 adults went for an overall health assessment. And 2 weeks after their assessment, they answered questions about their early life adversity and their current health through a home-administered pencil paper survey. The questions on ACEs were based on experiences before 18 years. And we also used individual ACEs to look at various health outcomes. But we also looked at a blunt instrument of the ACE score, the total number, to really look at dose-response relationships. Now, I'm not presenting all of the findings from the ACEs study, but this is a summary slide of what we essentially were able to document, that these early types of adversities are common. We found that 2/3 of adults experienced at least one adversity, and that we saw the beginning, the initiation of the outcomes related to ACEs started in adolescence, with the early initiation of risk behaviors that are known as the actual causes of death. And then we also saw direct relationships with these adult outcomes. Most importantly, we document and understand much better that ACEs are intergenerational. And what that essentially means is the adults in our study who experienced ACEs had health outcomes such as alcoholism, substance abuse, which were the same types of ACEs they experienced. So if their children are in the home, they would experience those ACEs as well. So the cycle can continue. And our goal is to break this cycle. We want to break the intergenerational cycle. So how do we do this? By applying salutogenesis to the ACEs science. And 20 years later, where are we after the ACEs study? One of the things that I've always tried to emphasize is that ACEs, first of all, they cannot be removed or prevented once they occur. We're not dealing with infectious diseases where you can provide an antibiotic and then the infectious agent hopefully just goes away, or a vaccine to prevent spread. They are very common exposures, and there are no vaccines or antibiotics. So we need to focus not just on prevention in the children, but we need to look at the adults who have survived these traumatic experiences and understand ways they've tried to overcome, survive, recover, and heal. So I also have my thoughts around pathogenesis versus salutogenesis. And when we think about the ACEs work and the ACEs science, what we have tended to focus on is using ACEs as a risk factor, what causes disease, what causes the actual causes of disease or the risk behaviors. We look more at the pathophysiology. So I'll show you a slide about that shortly. Avoiding the problems and preventing ACEs, which is very important. And I tend to think of all of this in an allopathic biomedical framework. So this is what we do in allopathy and biomedicine. But a salutogenesis basics is really thinking about, in the face of adversity, having experienced trauma, what promotes health and well-being even in that realm? And then instead of a pathophysiology, how do we look at salutophysiology? I think that was some of what Paula and Theodore were talking about it just now in the questions that they were discussing. You approach potential and growth, and it's really promoting health and well-being, and this can happen at any time in the lifespan. And my work right now is focusing on looking at other medical systems such as Ayurveda. We talked about meditation and mind-body. Well, a lot of those practices have originated in the 5,000-year-old medical system of India called Ayurveda. So the research questions that I have been investigating, and there are many, are what are the factors associated with reporting positive well-being among ACEs survivors? What helped or would have helped them overcome their adversities? When defining salutogenesis, what do survivors say about well-being and healing? And what does salutophysiology look like for survivors? And I hope to get through some of this briefly today in the 10-minute presentation with hopefully some discussion afterwards. So the first study I want to present is using a large database. It's the Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance System, which is a system administered by the CDC in the US to really examine chronic disease indicators and risk factors. In 2010, there were several states and the District of Columbia that administered the Adverse Childhood Experiences Questionnaire to adult respondents. The questionnaire included 8 of the original ACEs, 3 forms of abuse, sexual, emotional, physical abuse, and 5 forms of related household stressors. For this study, what I did is I took this large data set and I said I only wanted to look at those adults who reported 1 or more ACEs, and I operationalized them as trauma survivors. In this study, there were 12,000 adults who reported at least 1 adversity. I then looked at what types of evidence-based health-promoting factors might be associated with their health-related quality of life. So we looked at physical activity, smoking abstinence, emotional social support, and educational attainment being in the U.S. Greater than 12th grade, which is high school or greater. Questions that we looked at were the mentally unhealthy days and physically unhealthy days, past 30 days. So the more days that respondents said, the worse their health was. So we wanted to look at the relationship. Is it possible that these health-promoting factors reduce the number of unhealthy days in the past month? And the answer to our question was yes. When we looked at each of those each of the health-promoting factors, we found a significant reduction in the number of days reported. And looking at the total number of health-promoting factors they may have engaged in, we found a strong decrease in the number of past 30 days of mentally unhealthy and physically unhealthy sick days. In fact, for mentally unhealthy days, we compared to persons with only 0 or 1, so they were only engaging in one of those factors or only reported one of those factors, we found almost a 7-day decrease in their mentally unhealthy days. Another study that I'm currently still working on compiling and finalizing, it's more of a qualitative analysis. It's looking at internet web blog transcripts of survivors talking about their healing and recovery. And one of the things that we're finding in terms of the themes is that healing from trauma is a process and a journey. So the previous study I just showed was epidemiologic data, but when we really talk to and hear from trauma survivors, we understand more clearly that it's a process, it's a journey. There's going to be spiraling back. You know, you take 10 steps one step forward, 10 steps backwards. That's what we're hearing. But it does encompass more than the physical. It encompasses the emotional and mental, and most importantly, the spiritual component of well-being. And when we think about well-being, and salutogenesis as a whole. We're not just thinking about physical, we're thinking about the whole person. And then some of the transcripts also allude to the fact that alternative medical models are highly utilized, and this can include yoga, meditation, and the like. So when we think about salutophysiology, we already know the pathophysiology of trauma and stress. We understand that it has an impact on our neuroendocrine system, on our sympathetic, parasympathetic nervous system, the autonomic nervous system. But what can we glean from this research on survivorship in terms of seeing decrements in their unhealthy days? We know that actually these types of buffers can, that I have listed here, time and nature, reduces parasympathetic nervous system and increases parasympathetic activity. Meditation has been shown to increase immune response, leading to anti-inflammation. Sleep is very critical to reducing infection. And as we know, the literature for years has shown the importance of moderate exercise on multiple fronts, not just on our physical, but now it shows that it has a strong relationship with the dopamine system in our body. Social support is important to buffering the stress response and reducing cortisol levels. And of course, diet, proper diet and nutrition is important for all aspects of our health. In Ayurveda, the three pillars of prevention and well-being are sleep, diet, and exercise. And so when those are all properly implemented, we can actually promote our well-being and health. Limitations of the two studies I shared is they're cross-sectional. We can't make any causal inferences. They're not representative of all adults. But I do think that the studies that I've been engaging in kind of, if you will, lead us to a discussion around really having an eagle's eye. We have the sense of coherence model within salutogenesis, but as we think about salutogenesis, can we really start to think about salutophysiology, and as it relates to ACEs, the salutophysiology of survivorship? And I pose that we have more research and development on a salutophysiology framework, so that it can be integrated when ACEs science is shared and discussed. And finally, I also want to convey that salutogenesis is very important to our prevention framework for adversities. We have primary prevention, but we have to take a lifespan approach. Primary prevention of ACEs can really only occur in the children and adolescents. Health promotion and salutogenesis has to occur in the adults who've survived, and then only might we get to the prevention of the intergenerational transmission. So I thank you and welcome any questions.
Thank you, Shanta, for another wonderful presentation of a very integrative approach. Are there any questions? I do see someone requesting, I guess, your publication about the health behavior mentioned in the study.
Yes.
So maybe you can share that link or something in the chat.
Sure.
Is there anyone else with a question? Yes, Diana. Yes.
Hi, thank you so much. Fascinating. Sorry, put your piece in. A very fascinating study. I'm the director of the Department of Health Education and Promotion, so at a national level. So this is really interesting, especially for the work we do. Could you just reflect on the source of the health behavior information that you analyzed?
Sure.
Was it from patient records? Was it patient reporting? Thank you.
No, I appreciate that. And again, for a 10-minute presentation, it's a little difficult. But the Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance System is an annual surveillance system administered by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. During my time at the CDC, I led the development of an ACEs optional module which included questions about these adversities before 18 years of age. The BRFSS is a state-based, so we have 50 states and territories. So it's a state-based survey. It is representative of each state that administers the survey. It is not considered nationally representative at the US level, although I will say some people aggregate the data and try to say, oh, these are national estimates, but truly they're not national estimates. They're really representative for each state. So the states that took the ACE module in 2010, I think it was, you can go back, Vermont, Hawaii, the data I presented are representative to those states, to the adults in those states. So the questionnaire in the BRFSS has multiple items about health risk behaviors that are known to cause chronic diseases, as well as health status, whether they've been diagnosed with any chronic diseases. So the study I just presented from BRFSS, in those models, they are all weighted so that they do represent the states from which they come. And they also take into account non-response and they control for other chronic disorders. So it's a pretty, the models that were used, the statistical models are pretty, I would say strong in terms of the interpretation of what we found. Does that make sense?
Yes, yes, okay. It does. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Wonderful presentation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, we are actually almost at the end of this session already. And I would really like to thank all the speakers and of course the audience. And if anyone wants to further communicate with maybe one of the speakers, you can go into a Wonder Room when you look at the conference platform, and there you can meet people. You can search for different topics and there you can have meetings, or you can of course through the platform, you can directly send messages to each other. So because of course we don't have all the space for all the questions right now. So Shanta, do you want to have a final word?
I would love to. I would just like to say, first of all, on a personal note, this has been a fascinating conference for me, and I've really enjoyed hearing everybody's presentations, everybody's work as it relates to really moving salutogenesis forward. It's a very critical area. Europe has been far advanced in this research area. I'd love to see the US really move in the direction more so. I really think that it's needed worldwide and globally. And I just want to commend all of the speakers for the work that you're doing to continue this, moving this work forward, especially as it relates to workforce and employee-based teamwork in the medical field with Theodore's work, really helping practitioners to understand how to integrate, and just hoping that we continue to have these great conferences in years to come with more around this work. But thank you all for your wonderful presentations.
Okay, so it's goodbye for now because it's time for the coffee break. And after the coffee break, there is an interesting plenary dialogue, and this is about salutogenesis beyond the health sector. So that also includes, of course, the topics discussed here. So wish you a good conference.
Thank you. Thank you, Laura. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you, Shanta. Bye, everyone.
Bye.